I am going to deal with what happens to some neighborhoods, Camden, New Jersey, Philadelphia as a case in point. And I'm going to particularly focus on the neighborhood where I lived in West Philadelphia and what happened to it over a period of, let's say, 50 years. It was, to understand what happened, we need to go to one other person who's in the Chicago school, a guy by the name of Burgess. You will find all the details about Burgess's theory of concentric circles outlined very carefully in your textbook. Burgess said to understand cities, you have to have these circular units. Cities break down into units. The first unit is the center city. And there you have the office buildings. There you have the center of government. There you have the upper class shopping area. May I say, this is no longer the case, but that's the way it was. That's the center city. So we talk about center city. To a degree, that's still true in Philadelphia. If you go in Philadelphia, west of Broad Street, going down Chestnut Street, going down Walnut Street, you will find that the stores are upscale. They are very, very fancy stores. Now, once again, you're dealing with natural zones here. You cross Broad Street and go east of Broad on the same streets, and it's a pretty seedy kind of a place. That whole area is very, very run down. I mean, they try to rejuvenate it, but it hasn't really worked. If you want to go to the classy section, it's west of Broad Street, Chestnut, Walnut, Locust will work. And but you have the downtown area, namely the City Hall, the art centers. I was last night at the Academy of Music to see the Messiah done with ballet. Absolutely magnificent. I didn't think they could pull it off, but it was the only night this whole year I could go to the ballet, so I went last night, and it was just mind-boggling to see the Messiah done interpreted in by the Pennsylvania Ballet Company. I got to tell you, it makes liturgical dancing that you see in churches look very, very bad by comparison. I mean, it was absolutely magnificent, beautiful, beyond my wildest imagination. It didn't end with the Messiah. The Messiah was at the end of the first act. It was the way it ended was not with the Messiah. I think they had a better idea, but with the ascension of Jesus into heaven. And what nobody saw was as they were dancing along, somebody hooked a wire onto the guy. So that at a particular point when nobody was expecting it, all the disciples gather around, dancing around him, and he ascends up and disappears. And the place went wild. It was just great. Academy of Music, the whole art center, there's about five theaters, Merriman Theater, there's the Kimmel Center. I mean, they are all there within about a block of each other. The Walnut Street Theater, it's all there. It's this cultural center. It's the Academy of Fine Arts, the City Hall. All of these things are there in the center of the city. Before I go any further, let me say this about the city. Philadelphia, and this shows where cities take on certain cultural characteristics that make them quite distinct. Philadelphia is influenced by Paris. As a matter of fact, if you can't go to Paris, I hate to say it, go to Philadelphia. People say, you're kidding. Not at all. If you look at the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, which runs from City Hall to the Art Museum, may I point out to you that that boulevard is the exact dimension and design of the Champs-Élysées in Paris. Everybody knows about the Champs-Élysées. You don't have to go. Go downtown and look at the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. I mean, there it is. It's the exact replica of the Champs-Élysées in Paris. Not only that, but those of you who have been to Paris, and I understood a couple of you had been, if you come down from the Arc de Triomphe down to the end of the Champs-Élysées. It ends at a place called Place de Concorde, which is where there's a big obelisk at commemorating the guillotine and kind of regretting the ugly things that happened there. But there's a great obelisk there that was that Napoleon brought back from Egypt. You know, he stole it, brought it back, you know, and put it up there. And then if you continue on, you would come to the Louvre. But the Champs-Élysées basically ends at Place de Concorde. And if you go to the Place de Concorde, to your right, you will see two wonderful hotels, low-level hotels, because the buildings are all pretty much the same level. Two beautiful hotels, but you don't have to go there. You can go to the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. And at the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, coming up from the Art Museum, you will come to Logan Circle, or Square, i.e., very much replicating the Champs-Élysées end. And guess what? There are two buildings there that are almost exact copies of the hotels that sit right there at the Place de Concorde. The Free Library of Philadelphia and the Municipal Family Court. And there they sit. They don't look like regular city buildings. They just sit there, and they're magnificent buildings, and they sit there. Let's go a little further with the influence of France. If you look at the City Hall, other than the center tower that soars into the sky, that for years was the tallest building in Philadelphia, there was kind of an unwritten law that you couldn't build anything higher than City Hall. That long since has been violated. But there was City Hall, for years dominating the city, the tallest structure, a wonderful, wonderful building. But if you look at it closely, the lower part, you say, I've seen this building someplace before. And the answer is, of course you've seen it someplace before. It's the architecture replicates the way in which the Louvre, the great art museum in Paris, was constructed. Look at it, look at a picture of the Louvre, and you say, the same guy must have designed both of them. And indeed, there was an attempt to copy that building. Now, there's more to it than that. On top of City Hall, there's a statue of Billy Penn, the founder of Philadelphia, a huge statue, which incidentally was constructed by a French architect, by the name of Calder. Very important name, Calder. If you come down from City Hall towards the Art Museum on Benjamin Franklin Parkway, as I said, you come to Logan Circle, this wonderful park, and in the middle of it is an absolutely magnificent fountain. They don't have it running in the winter for obvious reasons. It freezes, but the statuary in this fountain just is mind-boggling. I don't like to brag, but I like it better than the Trevi Fountain in Rome. I really love this fountain. It's magnificent. If you want a good afternoon, get a book, go down to Logan Circle, sit there on a bench and look in, and there's this fountain in front of you. These just magnificent. It was designed and built by Calder's son, the guy who built William Penn, another French sculptor, puts in this particular fountain. Go on down the parkway, and you come to the Philadelphia Art Museum. I don't know whether you've been to the Philadelphia Art Museum, but if you go into the Philadelphia Art Museum, in the main atrium, which is mind-boggling, just absolutely mind-boggling, the main atrium, there's this gigantic mobile designed by the grandson, Calder. In other words, you can stand in the Philadelphia Art Museum and see three generations of French artists. The grandson, Calder, with the mobile. The son, Calder, the fountain. The ultimate patriarch making the great William Penn building. You will find that the collection of Rodin statues is not in Paris. It's in Philadelphia. It's right on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. They are going to be moving the Barnes collection from Lower Merion to the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, which will mean that the Benjamin Franklin Parkway will have the greatest collection of French art in the world, surpassing by far anything that exists in Paris. I guess you know about the Barnes, that it has, I mentioned that it has huge numbers of French paintings. I think the thing that I find most impressive about the Barnes collection is when you walk in the front door into the entrance area, into the vestibule that leads into the museum, there is a fresco that takes over the whole room. And it was done by Matisse. We actually brought Matisse to Philadelphia, and he did it right there. I mean, is this mind-boggling? And you say, this is so French. What's going on here? So very, very French. The answer is quite simple. Philadelphia was always in love with France, and the days go back to the Revolution. Remember, Philadelphia was the capital of the country when the American Revolution took place. And we probably would have lost the revolution had it not been for the French, who came in and supplied us with all kinds of help, including a very famous general who loved Philadelphia, General Lafayette. I mean, this is an incredible era. And the French supplied us with more materiel and troops, all kinds of things. And it's really questionable whether or not we could have won the revolution without the help of the French. The French, of course, were at odds with the English, and if we have common enemies, we suddenly become friends. And France and America became very close friends. Things have changed, of course. We're not exactly the best friends with France these days. I think Chris Rock says it well. You know America's messed up when the tallest man in the NBA is Chinese, when the best golfer in America is a black guy, when the best rapper in America is a white guy, when the Germans refuse to go to war, and when the French are calling the Americans arrogant, you know the world is messed up. You know, I think that's a great thing. It's this great connection with Philadelphia and France that goes all the way back to the Revolution. This is the tradition of a city. Note, cities get traditions. And this is the tradition of Philadelphia. Benjamin Franklin, the great Philadelphian, was the ambassador to France, connected Philadelphia to Paris in an intense way, and really made Paris a kind of sister city to Philadelphia. And so cities take on certain characters, especially the northeastern cities. Now, when you get out to the Midwest, I don't want to knock the Midwest, but when you've seen one of those towns, you've seen them all. Except for Chicago, and we'll get to Chicago in a minute, which is, I think, one of the most magnificent cities in the world. But generally speaking, you know, Indianapolis, Columbus, Ohio, you know what these cities have a kind of sameness to them. And it's these cities that Burgess was talking about. And he was talking about concentric circles. First, there's the downtown area. And I talked a lot about the influence of Paris because the downtown area of Philadelphia is very influenced by Parisian architecture and culture and values, etc. The next place out, as he would say, is the area of transition. Very often you have older factories in this area. It's as simple as that. There's older factories. There's deteriorating neighborhoods. The second ring is usually marked off by high crime, a lot of immigrants. This is the way it was. This isn't the way it is. Immigrants, it's a really, really difficult area to explain. It sits between the center city and the next ring, which is ring number three, the ring of working class homes. As you move to ring number four, you still have residences, but they're better residences. We have now moved out to Winfield. We have now moved out to the next ring out. They're upper middle class homes. And then you move from there to the suburbs, which of course in America has become the place where better people live, quote unquote, better in the socioeconomic sense. And now we've come up with another category that Burgess never anticipated, called the exurbanites. Spektorsky, a great sociologist, began to analyze the exurbanites. Exurbanites are what? You go to Bucks County, up here to New Hope, Pennsylvania. It's a lovely little river community. Fortunately, it's located close to a rail station that takes you into New York. The only problem with this, of course, is that New York is 60 miles away. But 60 miles away on the train is less than an hour. So you can go from New Hope into downtown Manhattan faster than you can get there from Newark, New Jersey, if you're driving. I mean, it's rapid transportation, so that people who work in places like New York come from places like New Hope, Pennsylvania, and places like Lumberton, New Jersey. Certainly Princeton has become a kind of an elitist place. And so you get this structure of cities. Now, once again, what we are dealing here with Burgess is an ideal type, an ideal type. Now, I want to talk to you just briefly about what happens among working class homes, because that's where my family lived. In the working class ring that surrounded the ring of transition. And I'll tell you what happened in my neighborhood. As I told you in an earlier time, this was largely settled by Jewish people. And that was the case all the way up to the end of World War II. Now, something happened at the end of World War II that broke down the natural barrier. The natural barrier being Market Street in Philadelphia. Philadelphia is intersected by two streets, Broad Street going north and south, and Market Street going east and west. In West Philadelphia, it was overwhelmingly white, running from Broad Street down, and basically from Market Street over south. But World War II changed everything. Something that I covered while we weren't in class, but you all heard me talk about, was the influence of the GI Bill of Rights. It sounds like such a good bill. Whenever you say no government program ever worked, you know, Republicans like to say, government never does anything right. Well, the GI Bill seemed to work brilliantly. First of all, it made possible education for brilliant people that would have never otherwise ever been able to go to universities and colleges. Some of the greatest scientists, I think 12 Nobel Prize winners, will admit that they would have never had a chance to go on to higher education. Nobel Prize winners, had it not been for the GI Bill. You came back from the war, you were able to go to the university on the GI Bill. When I came to Eastern, I was in the first graduating class to ever come through the school. We had the school filled with young men who were on the GI Bill, which made it strange for me because I felt like I was in a place where I didn't belong. Everybody was like 8, 9 years, 10 years older than I was, you see. My brother-in-law, who's much older than I am, was a colleague of mine here at Eastern. He had played ball at the Naval Academy, and he was on the basketball team. We played on the same basketball team, my older brother-in-law and myself. It was kind of wonderful. In addition to that, that first year, we had an incredibly successful basketball team because we had all of these transfers, young men who had gone off to war, had dropped out of college to go off to war, and had played on major teams, Cornell, Naval Academy. We had all these big teams, and these guys came back. And of course, we had all of these super jocks in this little tiny school, which at that time had 125 students. And we were going out on the basketball court, and we had 7 guys on the team. That was it. And it was wonderful. We were beating people left and right, left and right. I mean, we've never had as successful a team as we did that first year because we had all these GI guys coming back, and there were key athletes from big schools who were coming here because almost all the students at Eastern at that time were going into the Christian ministry. Almost all of them. So it was a great place to be, and it still is. But the GI Bill made education possible. But the GI Bill also stimulated house building. During the war, as you may remember, house building stopped cold. We didn't build houses. We didn't have metal to put in copper piping or even lead piping because all the metal was being used for the war effort. You could not imagine what it was like to be in World War II. I grew up in the middle of World War II. This war in Iraq is a disgrace. It's a disgrace in this sense that the life for the rest of us goes on as though nothing happened. We don't even pay attention to the war. If somebody got killed, it's on page two. I mean, it's just totally removed from the... And of course, my cynicism is that that's the way the administration wants it. Right now, there is no question in anybody's mind what they should have is a draft. Because they've got these guys over in Iraq that are there for extended periods of time and are having mental breakdowns and their families are falling apart because they're away from their wives and their kids because for such long periods of time. The National Guardsmen, who thought they were going to be there for 6 months, suddenly are there for a year, 2 years, a year and a half. And we're saying we can't recruit enough. We can't get enough people to go over and join the Army. Recruiting is down. We can't get people to go. People are defecting. We don't get that in the paper. The proportion of the Army of people who just don't report to duty when they come home, who just defect, who are out without cause. I mean, they are basically deserters. The desertion rate is high. The suicide rate is high. Psychological breakdown, as I said the other day, is incredibly high. We need a draft. But you can't institute the draft without, in fact, upsetting college students, because they get drafted. And college students are indifferent. I picked up the Waltonian, our school newspaper, and the political science teacher was saying, well, there's a high level of indifference to political issues here at Eastern. And there is. Who cares? Hey, man, we're having a great time. We're going to school. We're going to class. If you instituted the draft, which ran by the lottery, you know, you have no idea what it was like. One night, they had this big thing like it was a bingo game. You know, you see, with a date, February 1st, another ball February 2nd, another ball February 3rd, number 4. And one night, they had a drawing. You should have been here at that day. All the students in Guffin Hall, and I was the dorm proctor at the time. My wife and I and my children lived in Guffin Hall at that time. I couldn't believe it. All the guys come downstairs at 7 o'clock in the evening and sit around the television set. Can you imagine this? Just imagine the drama. Because you're going to be drafted in succession. They're going to draw birthdays. If the first number is drawn, if in my case, February 25th, if they drew February 25th, that means the first group of people that are going to be drafted are all the people who have birthdays on February 25th. They reach in and grab another ball. Let's say it's June 23rd. All the people who were born June 23rd are drafted in the second round. And so on, and so on, and so on, until the thing you hope for is that they'll draw your birthday at 365. And this is going to Vietnam. See, this is going to Vietnam. And by this time, we already know that Vietnam is destroying people. I mean, we already know that the guys are coming back freaked out on drugs, psychologically messed up. As I pointed out, a large proportion of the people that are on the streets as homeless people today are messed up emotional people because they are Vietnam War veterans. It's a frightening reality. It destroyed a generation. And you're sitting there and you're a student and you're in your sophomore year. And if they draw your number first, you can be sure you'll be out of school within weeks. When that happened, and I remember sitting there in that room and they pulled a number and one of the students, it was the first number drawn was his birthday. And I remember him just bursting into tears. This is the end of my life. School is over for me. Here he was, a brilliant student. School's over for me. Within weeks, I'm going to be in training. And within months, I'm going to be in Vietnam. And there's a strong probability I'll either get wounded or killed. Whoa. Can you begin to see what the impact was this? Needless to say, everybody at Eastern became politically interested. All of them began to discuss the war. And, you know, you get a lot of pro-war feeling around here right now, because Eastern's a conservative school, and there's a lot of Bush people here, and we believe in the war, we support the war. All of a sudden, when it's your name about to be drawn, you're suddenly not so enthusiastic about this war. You can understand this, can't you? Suddenly you're saying, I'm not sure this war is a good thing. As a matter of fact, I'd like to learn about this war. And we began to have these, what we call teach-ins, where for the first time, apart from class, a faculty member would sit in this room right next to where we're sitting here, and students would gather in, and he would start talking about the history of the war, how we got into this, and what it's all about, and what the issues are. And kids' eyes were wide open. I mean, because they were, well, here's what we would say philosophically, they were existentially involved. This was not simply some historical, political science course. This was their destiny. This was their future. The GI Bill made it possible for those who went to Vietnam, to those who went into the Korean War, for those who went into Second World War, to come home and go to college. And that was the only good thing that happened. But as these people came home from World War II, there were no houses, because all the metal was used for the war effort. What you would do if you lived as I did in World War II is you would go through your house, and every bit of metal that had no immediate use, you immediately put in a wagon and took it down to a garage in your neighborhood. There were these scrap drives, these metal scrap drives, where they collected metal to make shells, to make airplanes. Metal was collected all over the place. At Christmas, I remember as a boy, there was no such thing as a metal toy. Of course, this was before plastics. Your toys were made of cardboard. This was incredible. They were cardboard toys, because you would not use metal to make toys, because it all had to go to the war effort. Here was the thing that was absolutely amazing. Every woman in America was expected, after she cooked, to save the fat. And we would put them in coffee containers. And there would be grease collections, because the grease was used to make munitions. Every boy in our neighborhood was a junior air raid warden. And they gave you an armband and a whistle. And you went around and you collected fat and you collected scrap iron, and this was your patriotic duty. Wow, what a thing. And you never put your money in the bank, you bought war bonds. You walked into class, and the first thing in the morning was to salute the flag, to say a prayer, to read the Bible. And then the boys and girls would say, I want to buy 3 defense stamps. You'd buy these little stamps for 10 cents a piece, and when you'd fill the book, you could get a bond. I mean, it was total mobilization of the country. This war, Iraq, it's not total mobilization by any stretch of the imagination. We go about life as though nothing happened. All the baseball leagues all stopped. I guess you know that. They stopped baseball. They stopped professional football. Why? Because all the athletes were what? Being drafted. We did have a baseball league. You know what happened, don't you? We got a women's baseball league. They made a movie out of this. The women's baseball league came into play because, after all, in those days, we didn't have feminist movements, so women stayed home and the guys went overseas. It was mind-boggling. When these guys came home from the war, there were no houses because nothing was built for 4 years. The government wanted to stimulate the building of houses. So they made to construction people gigantic loans at very low interest rates so that these construction companies could build massive tracts of houses. The first Levittown was built by Levitt on Long Island. The second one was built just north of Philadelphia here, Levittown, Pennsylvania. Then they built another Levittown across the river. They had to change the name because it got very confusing with 2 Levittowns 2 miles apart, one in New Jersey, one in Philadelphia, just outside of Philadelphia. But these tracts were tracts with thousands of houses. You could buy a house. I think the median house in Levittown was $16,000. You could buy it for no down payment if you were a GI. You could buy it with a very low interest rate. so that in the end you could buy a house much cheaper than you could rent a house. This is what the government wanted. They wanted massive buildings of houses, and they wanted people to be able to buy them, especially veterans. And so the veterans were buying up these houses left and right. They came home by the hundreds of thousands, and they came back to their hometown, and they moved out to the suburbs. Please note, they did not want to do it. They did not want to live in Levittown. You say, but it's a lovely house. Remember what I said yesterday about ethnic communities. If you're an Italian, where do you want to live? In South Philadelphia. If you're German, you want to live in Germantown. If you're black, you want to live in the black community. I mean, you can just see what's going on here. This is an ethnic city. Everybody wanted to go back and live in their ethnic community. They wanted to live in that natural zone where they knew everybody and where their relatives were located and where they could have dinners on Sunday afternoon. And here we are, 25 miles away outside the city. And in those days, there were no super highways like the Dulles Expressway, the Schuylkill Expressway that would get you into the city. This was an hour trip to get into downtown Philly. You can imagine they didn't want to go there, but hey, it was the only thing you could buy, and it was a bargain, and they were new houses. And let me tell you, they weren't only new houses, but all the houses were equipped with refrigerators and stoves. And I mean, wow, what a deal. And so thousands and thousands of suburban houses were built. And you say, isn't this wonderful? It did enhance the construction thing. First of all, it meant that the suburban communities were not, quote unquote, ethnic neighborhoods, right? I mean, you can just see this. All kinds of ethnic people moved into Levittown, except for one ethnic group, African-Americans. And this is where there's a little bit of hinge on this. There's a book on Ed Rendell's administration called A Prayer for the City, in which the book really explains what happens to Philadelphia and why Philadelphia is the mess that poor Rendell, who's now the governor of the state, inherited when he became mayor. How do you solve the problem? You know, whoa. And they tried to trace the problems. And the tracing of the problems goes all the way back to the GI Bill, because there was a little clause within the GI Bill on the housing thing. And it was this: that the people who were moving into these new houses had to have a tendency to contribute to, here's the wording, the homogeneity of the community. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, all the houses that were purchased under the GI Bill had to be brand new houses. You can understand the logic of this. They were trying to stimulate the building and the buying of new houses. The way you get people to buy new houses is you force them to buy new houses. And the GI Bill said, you've got to buy a new house. So all the new houses that were being built in the suburbs under these GI Bill construction rulings were only available for people who would contribute to the homogeneity of the neighborhood. And so, in fact, African-American people coming back from the war found that they couldn't buy these houses. They couldn't move into these neighborhoods. See, this goes back to what Stephanie raised the other day. Are these separate communities which bring together people who are like each other really a good thing? In this case, the people that were brought together had one thing in common. They were white. Is this a good thing? Especially when African-American people who needed housing desperately could not move into these communities. You say, well, they'll just have to buy houses elsewhere. There's only one place they could buy houses, and that was in the city. That was in zone number two. Zone number two. Basic is this. They couldn't even buy houses in zone number two because all the houses in zone number two were old houses. Remember, I just told you, the houses had to be new. So you're an African-American guy, you risk your life on the front line, your white friends are moving out to these new houses on the suburbs, you're stuck in this inner city situation, and you can't even buy a house because there are no... You say, this is a ripoff of African-American people par excellence. Please understand what I'm driving at here. I'm driving at the fact that we had an oversimplistic explanation of white flight to the suburbs. You understood And everybody understood that the reason why the white people were moving to the suburbs is because they didn't want to live near black people. Wrong. That wasn't the reason. As a matter of fact, if you talk to the people who lived in the city, they were less prejudiced than ever before coming back from World War II. They had fought with these people. They had been friends with these people in the military. They knew these. They weren't. I think America is more racist today than it was then. And they say, well, white people wanted to move out of the city and they didn't want to be around black people, so they moved out. That's not the case. The new houses were only available to those who would contribute to the homogeneity of the neighborhood, which meant white people. And black people couldn't even buy houses in the inner city because all the inner city houses were old houses. They weren't new. They got ripped off at both ends of the stick. You see, racism suddenly is written into public policy. And see, when somebody says, all we have to do to overcome the racial prejudices of our time, all we have to do is get to know each other. If our church could just have a sister church that's black, and once a year, our pastor will go and preach in their church, and their pastor will come and preach in this church, and we'll even have a social once a year where we'll try to have a covered supper and all, and it will solve the whole problem. No, this is social policy that created the separation. This is what sociologists and theologians mean by structural evil. Structural evil. We think that sin is just personal. It's not personal. It's public policy. And in fact, without people wanting to be prejudiced, they are forced into segregated communities. Let me give you another one. After World War II, all these government housing projects went up. All over the place, all over Philadelphia, all over Pittsburgh. Government, you've seen these government, we call them the projects. Now, here's an interesting thing. They wanted these project houses to be available to people with low incomes. So in order to live in one of these homes, you would have to, in fact, say, I have to prove that I am low income. They want to check out your income tax forms. They want to check out your earnings. They want to know what your income is. And if you could prove that you were earning less than, let me just come up with a hypothetical figure, that your family was earning less than $20,000 a year back then you could have one of these government housing projects. Now, I want you to think about something now. Here are 7,000 housing units. Everybody that lives in this place is earning less than $20,000 a year. Every family in this is earning less. Are you beginning to get a picture of this neighborhood? Next thing. Suppose Sig here is living in Pasco Homes in Southwest Philadelphia, government housing project. And Sig, coming home, moves into this thing because he's got very poor income, but he decides to go to college under the GI Bill. And he gets a good education. And because he now has a college education, he gets a job. And he's not making $20,000 a year anymore. He's now making $50,000 a year. What are we going to do with Sig and his family? We're going to tell them that what? They have to move out. I want to ask you, what happens to a community where everybody in the neighborhood is an economic failure? And if anybody in the neighborhood should happen to succeed, you're going to force them to leave. Are you beginning to see a problem here? Are you beginning to see a very serious problem here? Namely, you're creating these communities of, I hate to say it because it sounds so evil, but it's true, of people who are basically failed. And everybody knows that they are failures. So when the kids from those projects go to school, the teachers, remember what I said the other day, expect them to fail. Label them as failures. And if it's real in the imagination, it's real in its consequences. Indeed, these kids come from the government housing projects. You can run studies on them. They're failures in school. That's one of the reasons why we started Cornerstone Christian Academy. We were working in a place where there was Bartram Village, Passyunk Homes, Pasco Homes. We had ministries in each of these areas. The kids were going to school. And one of our workers who was concerned about one of the kids went to see the kid's teacher because the mother wasn't particularly interested in the kid and kind of became a surrogate mother. Many of our workers become surrogate parents to these inner city kids. If you do inner city work, that's what's going to happen to you if you're doing it in the name of Jesus. And she couldn't believe it. She was a white woman from a very, very sophisticated background. And she was there out of the love of Christ. And she goes in to see the teacher. Note, it was an African-American student, but let me add to it. It was an African-American teacher. We're not talking about white against black. We're talking about certain black people looking upon other black people as though they're trash. And the way she talked about this child and just said, well, couldn't you do this? Couldn't you do that? And suddenly it dawned on her that this teacher basically felt that any energy or time invested in this child was a waste. It was a waste. This kid was never going. The teacher ended the conference by saying, let's be honest, this child isn't ever going to amount to anything. Where do you come up with a judgment like that? Easy. The kid comes from Passyunk Homes. It's on the records. The child is labeled. Remember labeling theory from yesterday. Very important in sociology. Because labeling tends to create a self-fulfilling prophecy. Once you are labeled, you tend to conform to the label that has been assigned to you. Do you begin to see the problems of a city? Do you begin to see what low-cost government housing does? And then you have people who drive by these government housing and say, this is a disgrace. Look at this place. These were lovely buildings that they put up. And look what these, quote-unquote, what these people have done to this neighborhood. Richard Allen Holmes in North Philadelphia. Look what these people have done to this community. Whoa, mind-boggling. But let's go a step further. Let's go back to West Philadelphia. I'm living on Delancey Street in West Philadelphia. West Philadelphia. Lovely street. I told you the other day it was a Jewish neighborhood. These were hardworking people. And what's more is, they were people who took education very seriously. West Philadelphia High School was one of the best academic institutions in the country. We got great education there. Let me tell you, when I walked into school, this is high school, my freshman year, I took history. Mr. McKenzie, PhD in history, high school. My chemistry teacher, PhD. My English teacher, PhD. The place was riveted, not with people who had gone through teachers' college and had credentials. The place was filled with people with graduate degrees. And in those days, hardly anybody went to college, let alone had a PhD degree. This was a high school. It was a magnificent school. As I talked to you yesterday about the basketball team, it kind of gave you a flavor of the whole nature of the place. I mean, it was a wonderful place to be. The war ends. African-American people are coming back into Philadelphia and they can't find any housing. Now I'll tell you the progression. A real estate agent finds a house for sale in this white community. And he deliberately makes that house available to an African-American family. Deliberately. We even had a name for it in those days. We called it blockbusting. There was a big bomb. We called them blockbusters during World War II that they would drag on London and it would blow away a whole block, blockbusters. And we began to call these real estate agents blockbusters because they would bust the block. Namely, here's an all-white block. We move a black commute family in. Once again, back to W.I. Thomas. If things are real in the imagination, they are real in their consequences. The minute the black family moves in, what do the white people think? What's going to happen to this neighborhood? What do you think is going through their mind?
Decreased property values.
What's that?
Decreased property values.
You've got it, Stephanie. Exactly. There goes the neighborhood. You heard that line, haven't you? There goes the neighborhood. The property values are going down. In reality, the property values don't go down at all. Once you make this block of people, block of houses, available, not just to white people, but to black people as well, you increase the demand. right? The number of buyers increases dramatically in Philadelphia at that time by about 15 to 16%. So you got 16 to maybe 15, maybe as many as 20% more buyers available. Law of supply and demand. If the supply of housing remains the same and the demand for housing increases, the number of buyers increases, what's going to happen to the value of the house? It's going to go up. But nobody knows this. It's at this point that the real estate agents begin to go door to door and knock on doors, as they did to my family, and said, you know, the new family that moved in up the street, you know, Rosella and her family moved up the street. Did you know that? Yeah, but they seem to be nice people. I know they're nice people. That's secondary to the point. You know what's going to happen to your house. Now you have two choices. You can sell now or you can wait. But every month you wait, the value of your house is going to go down a little lower, a little lower, a little lower. If you're going to get out, you'd better get out now. Now, you have to know my father. He almost punched a real estate agent in the mouth, you see. But we were an exceptional family in that respect. I'll tell you why my father was not the way he was. But let me just say, he was an exceptional, this is an exceptional situation. He almost leveled the real, but all the people on my street, listen very carefully. Within a month, there were for sale signs up and down that street. And you had, all of a sudden, panic selling. And now the real estate agent comes and says, you know, Elena, we have your house for sale, but we don't have any buyers right now. You bet there's too many houses for sale now. Listen, I can sell your house, but you wanted $20,000, which was a lot for a house then. I think the most I can get for you is $11,000. Your question is, well, okay, even then I don't think I'm going to be able to sell it right away. I'll tell you what, Elena, I'll buy the house from you right now. That way you can get out right away. Got the picture? So he's buying up these houses. And guess what he's doing? He's turning around and selling them to African-American families, which only heightens the panic selling. More and more signs are going up now, because now we don't have one African-American family on the block, we have five. The real estate agent is right. The neighborhood has gone down the tubes. It's panic now. Because of that, a law was passed in the city of Philadelphia, which only was undone this year. Namely, that when you had a house for sale in Philadelphia, you couldn't put a for sale sign out in front of the house. Some people said no, and that is if you lived in this second zone. If you were in downtown Philly, you could put a sign up. But if you were out here, you couldn't put for sale signs up. It was illegal. Now, it was a law that, after a period of time, was not enforced. Over the last 10 to 15 years, it's not been enforced. But it was still on the books up until this year. You couldn't put a for sale sign on, because what the poor city was trying to do was what? Stop this panic selling. So somebody was looking for a house, came on the street with 50 houses, 25 on one side, 25 on the other, saw 15 for sale signs up. You can imagine, I don't want to live in this neighborhood. This neighborhood is going through change. Now, at this point, because people aren't ready to buy the houses, we got another problem on our hands. And this is going to add to the real estate's profits. You're the banker. People want to buy houses, you got to give them loans. They go to the bank and they say, I want to buy a house on the 62nd block of Delancey Street. They look at the city map. These guys are not dumb. They're saying, this is a community in the process of transition. If I give this guy a $20,000 loan for a house, chances are that the value of that house is going to drop so rapidly that I'm holding a mortgage for $20,000 on a house that's only worth $10,000. Do you begin to see this? I better not give loans to people who live on this street. As a matter, we don't know whether they really did use a red pencil, but they would have a map of the city up and they would look to see where this new house is going to be mortgaged, and they would Say, in this neighborhood here, this whole area, this whole natural zone, there we are back to natural zones again. This whole natural zone is going through transition. And so you know where the natural barriers are, right? Remember, I talked about those yesterday. They'll put a red line around all the natural barriers. They've taken their sociology courses, and they're saying, we're not going to give any loans to people who want to buy houses in that neighborhood. Now you've got a real problem. Because people who are wanting to move into the neighborhood, who want to buy these houses, maybe African-American, Hispanic families want to move into this neighborhood. They go down to the bank and they can't get a mortgage because the area has been, here's the phrase, redlined. It's only in recent years that redlining has been declared illegal. You can't redline a neighborhood. But redlining became bank practices. And banks, in fact, redlined areas. Now you got an incredible problem because if people can't buy the houses and you got all these houses for sale, once again, law of supply and demand. Namely, a lot of people would like to buy these houses. The only problem is they can't get mortgages. So the number of buyers drops dramatically because people can't get mortgages. Got it? Law of supply and demand. If the houses are all for sale and there aren't many people who want to buy them, what's going to happen to the values of the houses? They go down even lower. At this point, real estate people really make a killing because they begin to buy up these houses. And they're not going to, they're really cheap. They're really cheap. You can buy, let me just say, you can buy a house in certain sections of Camden for about $100 or $300. These are really cheap. The real estate agents begin to buy them up because our African-American brothers and sisters have to live somewhere. We're going to let them live in this neighborhood, but they're not going to be able to buy the house, but they will be able to rent. So suddenly, instead of home ownership, you've got all these rentals up and down the street. Got the plot? Now, this wouldn't be so bad as long as the landlords what? Kept up the houses. Maintain them. If the toilet broke, they'd fix it. If the place needed a painting, they'd paint it. But they don't keep them up. You say, well, why wouldn't they keep them up? For obvious reasons. The houses will disintegrate. You say, well, why would they want it to disintegrate? First of all, they're charging very high rents on these houses. You can buy a house for $300, but if you want to rent it, it'll probably cost you like all kinds of money to rent the place. Rents are very high in these areas. Get this? Check it out sometime. If you want to do a sociological study, find out what rents are in the dilapidated neighborhoods of the city. You'll find that the rents are very, very high. You know, you say, I don't believe this. They're collecting high rents. They're not maintaining the properties. The properties disintegrate. And at a particular time, they disintegrate to such a point that they have to be condemned. You say, oh, isn't that sad for the owner? Oh, no. He writes the whole thing off as a tax loss. And so the whole neighborhood now looks pretty bad. Rentals that are not kept up. Houses that are being condemned. Does this look like Philadelphia? Does this look like North Philadelphia? Run-down houses. Rentals not maintained. And then people who lived on my street in Delancey would drive down Delancey Street because they wanted to see where they used to live when they were children. And say, oh, this is so sad. You know, when I was a kid, this was a wonderful neighborhood. It was a beautiful neighborhood. I mean, the houses were kept up. But ever since, quote unquote, these people moved in, it's gone down the tubes. Note, they are blaming it on the racial identity of the inhabitants. When in reality, the people who created the slum are who? The bankers and the real estate agents. Structural evil. We're blaming. You talk about something. This is called, we came up with a term for this. We called blaming the victim. Blaming the victim. You victimize people, and then you turn around and blame them for what you've done to them. All of this happens politically, socially, economically. Now, granted, I'm blowing this up beyond its actual, I'm creating an ideal type for you, an ideal type of disintegration of a neighborhood. Now, the real estate in certain places drops very, very low. Camden, New Jersey is a good example of it. I said to you, one out of every nine houses in Camden is deserted. There comes a point where the house is run down, beat up, it's condemned. The family just can't sell it. So what's the family do? Buys a house out in Merchantville or someplace in the suburbs of Camden and Haddonfield, and moves, Haddon Heights rather, they wouldn't go to Haddonfield, that's too upper class. Haddon Heights, and they'd move out there. And they just what? Leave the house behind. They just walk away from it. At one point, it's not this high anymore, at one point there were 40,000 deserted houses in Philadelphia. But it's not as simple as all of that. I said you could sell it, buy a house for $300. But if you're smart and you live in this neighborhood, you know something. You can call the junk dealer and he will come over and take out all the copper piping, take out the toilets, the sinks, he will take out the doors, the window fixtures, take out all, because all of these things can be sold. As a matter of fact, we can probably get somewhere around $3,000 if we just let the guy strip the house. We not only leave a house behind, but we leave a house behind that has been stripped of its wiring, of its pipes, of its toilets, of its windows, of its doors. It's a shell. And you've seen these all over Philadelphia. The only thing that the city can possibly do in this case is to move in and put plywood and board up the place, because if they don't, they will become drug houses. They will become places where druggies hang out, where all kinds of terrible rapes take place. They become hell holes. Of course, this all facilitates what has been often called the broken window syndrome. Namely, when one house on a block goes through this process, it tends to be like a cancer that spreads up and down the streets. And it's not long before the entire community is torn apart like this. Do you see? It's awful. This is what we call structural evil. Namely, it's not, you're blaming the wrong people. You're blaming the victim. Instead of, in fact, trying to sociologically analyze what happened to this community and what social forces were at work. Once again, I go back to the book of Ephesians. Brothers and sisters, we wrestle not just against flesh and blood. Granted that people have their problems. Granted we have some rotten people out there who do some rotten things in the neighborhood. So don't say that there aren't rotten people. There are rotten whites, there are rotten blacks, there are rotten Hispanics, there are rotten Italians. Well, not many rotten Italians, but I mean, you know what I mean. They're all out there. But for the most part, people aren't that way. But you see, we're not, that's the flesh and blood. And you say, we got to deal with these people, these people. Brothers and sisters, we're not dealing with these people, flesh and blood. We are wrestling against principalities and powers and rulers in high places. When Jesus was on the cross, I love this, he stripped naked the principalities and powers and expose them for what they really are. That is the task of a Christian sociologist. And if you're going into social justice, that's your task, to basically strip naked. I love that phraseology from the third chapter of Colossians. He stripped naked the principalities and powers. Expose them for what they are. Let the people know what they're doing. Create. You know, and what they'll say about you? You're nothing but a troublemaker. You come in here and you're just a rabble rouser. And yeah, that's what you're supposed to be. But let me tell you about the first rabble rouser. He's described in the Bible. His name is Jesus. And when they put him on the cross, this is the accusation. Note, everybody says he's innocent. You know, he's innocent. He never committed a sin. Oh, not on a personal level. On a social level, he committed a great sin. Here's what it says, point blank. It says, he stirreth up the people. Did he? Did he create a lot of discontent with the ruling establishment? Yes, he did. That is the greatest sin of all. He stirreth up the people. You who are going to work in inner city situations, that's one of your responsibilities, to stir up the people. But to stir up the people after you've done exhaustive research. Do we understand each other at this point?